Hello, this is Jeffrey Milburn, and this is the Omni Art Salon, number 118. When I first met Elsie Mayo a few years ago, I thought, now here's a gal who's smart and sophisticated, has a quick wit and piercing insight into business and the ideas behind consciousness in that arena. In the dialogue that Elsie and I had just a few days ago, I found that not only was my first impression true, but I was impressed with how much Elsie has immersed herself into her life and her business and really listened to the new directions she gets, and she follows them passionately on a path of her own self-discovery. Elsie Mayo is the president of Mayo & Company, and she is the counselor to top executives in Europe and North America, and has been doing this for the past 25 years. She is referred to as the guru of value-based branding as she guides multinational policymakers and their operating teams to integrate profit and social impact priorities to secure market advantage. Elsie has a unique talent for speaking about her firm's trademarked soul branding framework, for aligning corporate behavior with higher social values and integrity. And this is very pertinent in the business environment today, as you well know. The soul branding methodology for building high-performance enterprises of deep social integrity anticipated the current global trends in this direction. Brands, Elsie says, are synonymous with the organization itself. Mayo & Company teaches soul branding principles to help corporate leaders use the power of their brands to meet and even lead the swelling demand for authenticity and citizenship sought by customers, employees, suppliers, and other critical stakeholders in the current economic world. I invite you now to listen to one of the world's thought leaders who is really making a difference in how the character of our global business environment is being shaped to better reflect a more conscious and heart-centered reality for the future. And so the Omni Art Salon now proudly presents The True Soul of Business with Elsie Mayo. How are you today?
I'm fine, Jeffrey. Thank you.
You've been traveling a lot, and now you're here in Santa Fe. You've been here for a month.
I'm happily here.
Yes.
Back home.
Do you travel nationally or internationally or both? Or
both.
What's your most focused area that you've been traveling to in the last, say, 6 months or so?
I've been back and forth to Europe a lot, in particular Germany and Greece.
Oh, interesting. Well, those are wonderful locations.
They certainly are.
And Germany is such an industrial country. I mean, they're so organized. I love going to Germany because it's so clean and everything runs very well. They have wonderful cars. I drive a Volkswagen.
Mm-hmm.
I like them.
Mm-hmm.
I was also born there, so, but I'm not German.
Well, I'm enjoying Germany a lot, too. For the reasons that you cited, and also because there is this incredible excitement going on. I think it's emanating from Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's an undercurrent of a shift in the energetic somewhat from America as leader to it's kind of up for grabs, but certainly Russia is going to be exerting much more influence.
Well, there is no leadership in America, at least politically, at this point. We have retrogression. And retrogression is never leadership. Leadership is all... If you think of a leader, what do? They stand at the front of the group and they point in the direction we're going. Isn't that correct?
Because
there's always motion in the thermodynamic universe. So if the motion is in reverse, there's no leadership. It's by definition there's no leadership. So, but well, hopefully that'll change in the next year.
Yeah, there's a lot that's, there's change in the air, which feels really good.
Yeah, it does. And also, coming from Europe, you probably even notice it more, don't you?
Well, it's a wonderful perspective to have on one's own country and culture.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, American culture still is kind of the standard against which other expressions are measured, it's copied, etc. We still are the guys who set the tone with marketing and brands. Mm. On the other hand, there's, and then there's also, and I said that I was in Greece for a bit, you know, Greece is now, and the other countries that are entering the EU, it's kind of given them the fuel to enter with both feet, the economic scene, the political scene, the social scene. And what's exciting there is that they don't have to, they can skip some of the learning curves, particularly in terms of the role of the corporation in society. So
it's interesting, too, because the United States was so far ahead of Europe after the war, the World War II. And it's because we didn't really have any damage. You know, we were able to build all these factories. But now, but then we sort of hit a crest, and it seems like it is now we're getting old. Our factories, our infrastructure is falling apart, and Europe and Japan and these other nations that have had the time to build are actually probably have a lot more fresh equipment than we do. So it's kind of like, it's probably a good thing, and that's how, you know, even relationships work. One person grows and the other person is kind of a back and forth thing.
Yeah, and the other thing that's interesting here are the unseen energies. You know, you talked about plant and equipment aging, sure, but what is it that kind of determines that movement? It's the unseen energy. It's the, you know, the moral position, the moral leadership that America had after the war, the fact that we were so open-armed. You know, our arms were open. We welcomed people. We were optimistic. We represented hope. And particularly in countries where the hierarchy of your heritage and your ancestry determined what you would be doing in your life.
Oh, right. It's true. Very traditional cultures.
We really were. We broke the mold. And so we're a bit perhaps stagnant in that, and it shows.
Well, you know, I understand this going. That's happened a lot in England. The economics there in the last 10 years have been really remarkable. I think I read just not too long ago that the average income in America actually is below the English for the first time ever. And so it shows that they've really adapted some of these, you know, free market concepts and really made them part of their culture, which is really unexpected in a way. But at the same time, now we can maybe learn from our students.
Yeah, it's also interesting to notice that not only did they adopt the free market culture, but in the past 10 years, the UK and the Nordic countries in particular have brought it to another level. And they have brought an authentic commitment to social well-being through commerce. Perhaps not as fully as any of us would like to see, but the Nordic countries and the UK have been leading the way in that.
Interesting.
So when you look at the adoption curve around the world of the changing role of the corporation as a citizen and as a member of a larger society, it's the ideas get started and implemented most effectively first in the Nordic countries. Then they migrate to the UK, Australia, Canada, parts of Europe, and then the U.S.
Do you think they're more socially educated than Americans? Do you think there's a reason for that, that's more of a core reason within their culture that they have? Because a lot of those countries you've described, they've got more social systems that are built into their government. For instance, in England, they wouldn't even think of their citizens not having health care. It's just, it would be anathema. It makes no sense. They've had it since 1948. Do you think that's sort of because of that, there's been more of a shared social responsibility that was even in the governmental leadership, and that's kind of fostered a different kind of society?
I don't know the answer to where it started, but I do know that there is, on a very personal level, a greater sensitivity of one's immediate group and community. And by sensitivity, I mean it shows up in manners, in very simple ways. And it shows up in, at least in Germany, I mean, 10, 15 years ago when I started doing some work there, people were at checkout counters were unpacking consumer goods that they felt had just too much cardboard around them, and then they would take the product out and leave the package at the cashier and say, you deal with this.
Really?
That was, you know, 10 to 15 years ago. So the consciousness of a system,
mm-hmm.
of being part of a system that's closed, whereas in America, you know, it's kind of like the hubris of the hero. You know, what's your greatest strength is also your greatest weakness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our greatest strength being unlimited resources, a sense of opportunity that was endless, kind of like more like a rocket shooting off into space, in contrast to societies that had a very clear understanding of what goes around comes around, and that, you know, in their small communities where land was limited and resources mm-hmm. are limited, they know that trash is going to wind up being something they'll have to deal with or pay for. So I think part of the difference also is a growing sense of system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think when I was in France, I went to school there in college, and I noticed that there was a very heightened sense of limitation because the country's only as big as one of our states. And you got the quality in architecture, the quality in building was so much higher. Things were built to last because they had a sense of the value of how they needed to make things last. And Americans, you know, it's even like the American cars back in the 70s and 80s even, these huge boats. And the reason they were so big, I mean, we have this massive country. It's really big. I mean, I remember reading just not too long ago Prince William saying, oh, my God, it's a huge, monstrous place. You know, it really kind of freaks him out because England's kind of cute in comparison. And, you know, we built these cars for long-distance travel. We didn't build it for acuity. We were used to getting on the freeway and just, like, you know, pointing the car in a direction and pushing the gas and going. And we wanted
straight
to be comfortable.
For a long time.
Right. And we wanted to be riding around in a cushy living room. So that's how they were created. And we're now learning that that things are smaller. There's limitation to everything. And because global warming coming in is informing everybody. And Europeans are much, much more aware, I think, than Americans are on that front.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's talk about your work, because it's really interesting, not that that isn't your work, but you have some focused work with corporations, and you're going to be presenting at the upcoming International Conference on Business and Consciousness here in Santa Fe, and you have a whole series of things that you bring to the table for companies to look at, and one of them is a really interesting idea of what you call soul branding
mm-hmm.
for the company. And I want to get into that in just a second, but you said something else in some of your literature I wanted to open up with, and that is you foresee a coming corporate responsibility tsunami, and that there's this wave of need for companies to be responsible. How do you see that, and why is that happening?
Actually, that came from an article that I published in 1998.
Oh, okay, so we're talking 10 years.
So it was 10 years ago that we saw it coming.
Okay. Well, did it hit?
I think it's hit. We saw it coming, and where did it come from? It's still useful, I think, to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. You know, oh, absolutely.
Forces of change. We saw it coming in Europe first.
Okay.
And whereas at that time, you know, they were cooking this idea of perhaps there's going to be a united Europe, or at least an EU.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of an amorphous thing. But certainly the thinking was, we're going to be shaping our future, and how do we want it to look? And so those commissioners were very deliberately thinking about what should be the position of this state or group of states, country states, toward business? What role should business play in our society? So they may have had a leg up on us mm-hmm. in that they were asking the question because they had this immediate need to start to articulate what would the EU look like,
mm-hmm.
Even before there was an immediate.
And it was originally an economic union. I mean, that's the basis for the union, is it
coal,
not?
Yeah, it was somehow related to coal and
money, and how the money is created, and the currency, and, you know, equalizing all the currencies, which is, a lot of people resisted. But I think it's brought a sense of equilibrium, too, in the long run, has it not?
Perhaps. you know, there's also the cultural flailings about, you know, about not losing the cultural identities of those mm-hmm. countries while trying to maximize a homogenous market where, you know, you can look at the U.S. market. It's part of our power is that no matter where you are here, you can buy whatever you want.
With a dollar.
With a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And without duties, state to state, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's much, the machinations make it much more difficult to do that in Europe. So there's not a cohesive marketplace,
mm-hmm.
which diminishes its trading power mm-hmm. and buying power, especially when you think about China and its. So as a countervailing marketplace, that was another reason for it to come about. But at any rate, over there, they had a leg up on us in thinking through what would be the responsibility of companies.
Mm-hmm.
And very interesting things started to happen because practices emerged that, for example, demonstrated that companies that were behaving in a much more transparent and strategic manner, were managed that way overtly, performed better in the stock market.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so this work was done originally in Switzerland, and then Dow Jones collaborated with this organization, the Swiss organization, and launched the Dow Jones. It was the Sustainable Global Index. I'm not sure of the name mm-hmm. right now, but that was the idea. And so the awareness in the financial markets of a superior performance, business performance, that may come from a more conscious way of managing started to show itself
mm-hmm.
and gave fuel to the socially responsible investment market here.
Interesting.
So the socially responsible investment market, now we're looping back to answer your question about where did this coming tsunami come from. Part of the pressure came from best practices that emerged from Europe. Showed that companies that manage themselves more consciously and with greater sense of their social impact actually were rewarded in the stock market. The second way is the socially responsible investment sector started growing in the States
mm-hmm.
Rather significantly. The third is, you know, it's technology. It's the internet. Suddenly everybody has an opinion that gets heard.
Yeah, that's really a major shift, isn't it?
And one of our clients is a public relations firm that specializes in the internet and has some proprietary technology that lets their clients and companies understand where influence is tracking from.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas before influence came from, you know, print media, paid PR. Influence is more and more tracking from blogs and from clusters of blogs and from communities that are populating the internet. So that, for example, the feed that we see across the bottom of our TV screens on whether it's CNN or MSNBC, many of those are picked up directly from Yahoo's posting of blogs.
Interesting.
So, and where do blogs come from? Certainly some are organized, but in very many ways it's highly democratized.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the pressure is also coming from the people. The more we know, the more we are going to hold corporations accountable,
mm-hmm.
whether it's for fluoride in the toothpaste or it's for, you know, and also word about problems spreads very quickly. Food contamination, for example, can kill brands overnight
mm-hmm.
because of the information on the internet. And then, of course, there's the and then global warming just kind of, you know, popped out of the jack-in-the-box finally here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the other side of the pond, they've been grappling with that and really trading off how often they're going to take their families on holiday by jet versus driving versus, you know, bicycling.
Mm-hmm.
They've been contemplating that for years. And you can see the proliferation of websites and communities of interest that were based overseas that are now models for ours about green living, etc. So the pressure is coming from the people. It's coming institutionally because you just perform better. And now with global warming, it's coming from governments. Increasingly, it will.
Mm-hmm. So now I'd like to get into the idea of soul branding for a company with all that. Because that's a real context for this. And you first described that most companies brand their... How do most companies brand their products who are not interested in soul branding? Let's talk about the negation of it not existing first, so we have a little context for it.
Well, one of the other differences, we keep referring back to the global setting, and I'll do that again here. One of the great accomplishments of American-grown business is this field called marketing. We have honed it to perfection. It is an industry in itself, as you know, and the world watches and copies what we're doing. We have come to understand that what people buy is partly relates to the functionality of what they are buying. You know, how well does that car work? How often does it break down? Functionality, mm-hmm. price, performance. And there's another piece of your purchase decision that comes from something unseen, untouchable, and almost unquantifiable.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what we call the brand halo. And I use that word and give attribution to one of my company's first clients in 1994. I started this company. And our first client was IBM. And one of our clients there, when I asked her, what is it? Why do you want to work with us? What is it that you're looking for? And she said, well, you know, we're looking to have the kind of halo that at the time Microsoft had, which enabled it to price at a premium, enabled it to make mistakes in its software and people forgave it, et cetera. So this notion of a brand halo, it's that intangible aura associated with a set of products, if you will, that make people feel this is the best choice for me. And it reflects on me on a deep level emotionally, not just functionally.
I just think it's also an identification with a particular status of a particular group of products.
Certainly mm-hmm. with the luxury products.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and in very many ways, part of the way a brand functions is that your loyal customer personally identifies, as you say, you know, with the status of it or other attributes of it.
I'm a PC guy, not an Apple guy.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your father's Oldsmobile, you know. Yes, exactly. So soul branding. Having done this for a very long time, after McKinsey, I went into the field of corporate identity and branding in 1984, where I, you know, was absolutely mesmerized and participated in honing this practice of branding and marketing. And it occurred to me personally that there was a certain staleness creeping in and a certain amount of mechanical aspect and perhaps manipulation that was increasingly divorced from what actually was being sold. In other words, we've heard about advertising creating needs
mm-hmm.
and playing on insecurities or playing on fears. And frankly, I thought, you know what? I think that business can be a vehicle to edify the human spirit. I think that business can be the vehicle that de facto addresses in a positive way some of the social ills that we see increasingly. And I think that people really want it, they just don't know they can do it. So what we've done is we've developed this idea called soul branding, which essentially encourages clients to connect who they are as an organization with what they make and how they sell it in a very deliberate way.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we start with the values of the company and we help them quantitatively benchmark those values and aspirationally ask the employees, now, if this company were fully living those values, what would it be doing differently?
That's a good answer. That's a good question.
And so at every level in the organization, the company develops a blueprint for where its people want to see it go.
Do you get a lot of surprises with those questions?
Yes, we do. We do. We usually come into it, and so do our clients. Our clients typically are the CEO, the C-suite, chief marketing officer, the chief talent officer. And the problems that they have either are, you know, we want to grow quickly and we need to build our leadership team to do that, so we want to articulate our values. Or we want to get into a new segment of the market, so we need to tweak our brand. So we comment for different reasons, but we always start with the authentic heart of the company, which is its value system.
And have you worked with brand new companies as well that are just starting, or
yes,
mostly establishment companies?
Well, actually both, but more recently with newer ones. Out of the personal preference of my team, which are veterans in the world of management consulting from McKinsey or from public relations or from HR or research, we're at the point where we've been there, we've seen it, we've done it, and now we see the potential to actually do something big with it. So I forgot your original question, but small companies?
Well, two things. The surprises you run into when you ask the employees, what are we doing, or what are we not doing to match what you think is the value of the company? Because most companies have some kind of mission statement, even the most rudimentarily developed ones, I would think. So they have at least that much down. But, you know, to ask the employees what their input is, especially the non-CEO levels, is rather radical.
It is radical, and it's got to be radical. We need a radical antidote to American-style marketing because it has become completely separated. It's almost like a limb has been cut off from the body of the company. Marketing has become this self-perpetuating and very often dead set of promises. Now, yes, companies have mission statements. We've gone through the motions. We have the templates. You can go on the internet, push a button, and get a template for creating a brand or get a template for creating a mission statement. But what we need is the organic body of the organization breathing it, living it, and glorying in it. And that only happens when they're participating in it.
Well, I have a friend. I used to work with a company in Boulder 10 years ago, maybe, late 90s, actually, not too long ago. And he had done a whole, he's written a book, actually, you can buy it on Amazon now. It's called The Growth Curve. And he traces the development of small companies and multinational corporations. And he says they're organic entities. And that the ones that are the most successful are doing precisely what you're talking about. There's one company in Sweden that is 900 years old. And the reason it survived, it was adaptable. It kept moving from one industry to the next because the company zeitgeist, the spirit of the company, was to serve society. So they'd say, well, this is not working anymore. It's not like they had to go hammer that, you know, that cigarette industry into the ground before we switch over. They just naturally switched over to new industries. And they survived all these years. They're like an adaptable, organic entity. And one of the tenets of that was that you listen to the people. The janitor in the company is a human being with intelligence and creativity. And when you let the thing manage from the ground up, it works.
Exactly. And when you talk about one of the primary drivers, just to get really tactical right now, of the corporate agenda is innovation. You'll see, you know, everybody, all the ads, all the websites are touting innovation because we've painted ourselves into a box. Now, where does innovation come from? It comes from human beings feeling respected, creatively stimulated, and with their insights looping into a system that uses them. So this is what I mean about, I think, what we need now is an antidote to what we've been best at, which is marketing. Marketing as an outward-directed megaphone toward stakeholders. And the really big DNA-type transformation that we're going through is we're turning the megaphone around because our customers and our stakeholders now are holding the microphones. They're on the internet. They're calling the shots. Mm-hmm. The corporation of tomorrow is going to have a new set of ears, and it's going to grow some that it doesn't even have. So that's the big challenge. So this notion of soul branding really is, it is simply a little moniker for a major transformation, which is about listening to the soul of humanity as it's expressed in your organization and in your different stakeholder groups. And that soul has a need for functional products and services, and that soul also has a need for its community to be healthy,
mm-hmm.
its global community, not just its, and its immediate community. And it also, the soul is not just, you know, I just parenthetically will say what soul branding is not. It is not simply authentically representing the essence of the company. I've seen things published recently that say that's what a soul, you know, the brand of a soul is. I would say that it's our job to recognize and to lead the aspirational impulses of humanity out of the current sense of despair mm-hmm. and overwhelm because of this realization that, oh my God, we are in a global system here. You know, it's the veils off, folks. Global warming, the climate has really helped us understand that, and China's helping us understand that.
Yeah.
And it's overwhelming, and it can push you into a sense of defeat. Our job as leaders, whether we're leaders of organizations, of companies, thought leaders, is to get out there and say, you know what, there is a way that this can work, and it's when you go to your heart and soul, tap into your creativity in the service of the community.
Mm-hmm. And the greater whole.
The greater good.
The greater good, right? And you know, it's interesting, as you were talking about this, I was thinking of a lot of people, and I think this is pretty common in world culture, not just the United States, but they think of a company and they think of the company's logo. It's so important for people to have logos, and the company logo is worked and worked and worked, and so it's so perfect. It's very simple. You see it at a glance, and you know that's AT&T, that's IBM, that's McDonald's, that's blah blah. And I remember one time seeing an art show in New York at a gallery. It was great. It was all these two guys from London had taken computers and phones and all office machinery. Everything was painted gold. And then it was just piled in the middle of the room, all this material from corporate reality. And then all the walls were covered with logos. And they had the logo of the Vatican. They had the logo of the churches. They had the logo of every aspect in society. It was brilliant. It was a brilliant installation. And you know what? I think that's what makes people feel that corporations aren't made of people.
Yeah.
You see what I'm talking about? It's almost mm-hmm. like one of the things that I always find interesting, I have this personal experience. I'll go to a company or a business, and I'll feel an apprehension because there's this formidable entity with a big building and the parking lot and all the stuff. And you don't just see the people at their desks. You don't see the interaction. You don't see, like, Mary down the thing who always brings the croissant Friday. Or, you know, there's that personality of a company that is the soul. I would say it's a collective soul of whatever their shared endeavor is. But people don't see that. They see the logo. They see the corporate entity. And there's a real major distrust of corporations as being greed heads and greed mongers, and that they've been completely irresponsible, and their only thing they care about is whether they make more money than you do, and that they survive at the expense of whatever they survive. How do you soften that? How do we bring the corporation into a new paradigm that people really start to see as part of their lives, as part of their society, that's an integral part that's really is responsible and is made up of individuals who are just like you and I.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's a big thing to leap through.
It is. And it's, I think you've put your finger on the transition that we're in. I feel really privileged to be living in a time with the transition almost feels to me like emerging from the Middle Ages or not.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where this is going to go. It could go into a renaissance. you know,
the
glory of the Renaissance.
There's no doubt that potential's there.
Or it could go some other way. But how do you soften it? We think you soften it by empowering the best impulse in human beings in the organization. And you give it a voice in the context of a shared fate. Now, one of my colleagues that I'm privileged to have work on my teams is one of the most brilliant people that I know, who also is one of the most practical people that I know, Doug Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And Doug Smith, among other things, he won't brag about this, so I will. I mean, he's had 6 best-selling business books. He basically architected and implemented McKinsey's knowledge management system.
Mm-hmm.
He built its organization practice. And he not only does he do those big lofty things, but, you know, he gets results. I mean, he in the Guru Guide, he's voted as one of the highest impact management consultants.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's that stuff. So this is my team, you know. I mean, these are the people who are on my team, folks who are extremely seasoned, accomplished, and are putting their brilliance at work to helping the shift we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you soften it? Well, just to backtrack a little bit, you spoke a little earlier about language.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say the language of the culture of the company.
Yeah. And think about language, naming. Naming is something that we do because it makes knowable or ownable or controllable or less fearsome complicated things that may challenge us, right?
Mm-hmm.
So names, we'll gravitate toward names because it makes things knowable and graspable.
Mm-hmm.
Brand names are kind of an uber expression of that.
Mm-hmm.
Companies, and I talk about marketing, we need an antidote to marketing. We need an antidote to the practice of marketing that has made brands into shields that deflect truth, inquiry, and genuine human interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, we're not going to have to work too hard because the internet's doing that for us.
Well, it's a natural inclination for humanity to gravitate towards truth. And I think that regardless of the obstacles that are in its way, it continually happens generation after generation. The internet's the greatest gift to our generation because it's an unencumbered communication medium at this point.
Right. So to complete the analogy, maybe this works and maybe it doesn't. In many ways, the stalwart corporate brand today is kind of like the Maginot Line
mm-hmm.
in World War II. You set it up and it can deflect anything, but guess what? They go around it. It becomes irrelevant because we can get to the truth through our, you know, employees on the internet are the highest trusted source of information.
Interesting.
Employee blogs. There's no way for corporations to get around this. The old command and control approach, which, you know, we talked about World War II, mm-hmm. which worked so well then, is will defeat us because it will keep the company from the rich source of input
mm-hmm.
of employees and external stakeholders.
Well, it's interesting you're talking about this because I feel like there's, like we talked earlier about retrogression in our society and politically. I had a podcast with John Bogle, a well-known financial genius who created the Vanguard Group, the second largest mutual fund company in the world. Pretty major undertaking. And he was talking about the disparity that has occurred in corporate CEO pay over the last 10 or 15 years, the increase of the disparity of the CEO's pay and the average person in the company and how they're paid. And so you're talking about this uprising within the ranks of the companies communicating outwardly. The company can no longer deflect all this information. And yet, is there some kind of protective measure going on where the CEOs are like hoarding the money at the top? Is there like a countervailing force that needs to be reintegrated into the company so there's not this feeling of really a monarchy system, a royalistic system of the kings and their kingdoms? It's feudal. It's a feudal structure. And do you see this maybe a change coming in that?
I see.
Past this, right, this period we're in right now is kind of a gripping period. It feels like constipation to me. I feel like everybody's hanging on to the Christian religion. They're hanging on to all these things because it scares the hell out of them. The universe is huge, and they're really not wanting to face the fact that they are an individual spark of divine intelligence with complete authority and responsibility for their existence. They're trying to hide behind everything. And, you know, the corporations is based on the old model. You had the priest, the church, you had the pope, all that kind of thing. You had all these leaders. You have CEOs. You have all the minions. And all of a sudden, the minions are finding, well, I have a voice. I have an opportunity to express myself. And then, of course, that's old structure. The CEOs with their million-dollar salaries and the other guy making $50,000 a year, just knowing three offices away, so to speak. What's happening? Do you think it's going to break down and become more equilateral?
I think your characterization of the time and the reaction as gripping is perfect. And, you know, the pendulum swings to one extreme before it comes back to the middle.
It's a fear thing, too, don't you think? It's all about fear of the future.
I think so. And, you know, we can now get into psychology, personal development. What's exciting for me about this time is that the institutions really are reflecting the change that needs to happen on us, each mm-hmm. of us, within each of us. And it's the circumstances are forcing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to go too far astray. I want to go back to this point about pay differentials.
Mm-hmm.
Just this week.
Because that's so key.
Yeah, just this week, there was a lot of pushback in Germany in particular. I mean, it was in the news, not because I was there recently, on exactly this point. That the citizenry, it was characterized in a news report, was outraged that the top levels of management in certain German companies were starting to mimic that vast differential,
mm-hmm.
200 times, earning 200 times what the average person earns in American companies. And so there's a backlash there in Europe. Once again, we look to Europe and we see that the citizenry has a greater sense of its entitlement to fairness,
mm-hmm.
to more sociable behavior. The other thing that's a sad statement, but true, is the concentration of wealth here in the United States. Something like 1% of the population owns 99% of the wealth.
It's a monarchy. It's a feudal system.
So, you know, I don't know that we have the civic sensibility and courage and sense of outrage to push back. In many ways, we're like sheep. And again, I look at marketing and how good we're at marketing. And
mm-hmm.
that's been to our detriment in many ways. But yeah, the systems are creaking and squeaking, and something's going to pop.
How are they actually making a difference to citizenry in Germany? What is their leverage? Is it just through votes in the government and some kind of supervision from the government on these individuals who are doing this Americanized system of vast accumulations at the top?
Public outcry. There's somehow shame seems to have more of an impact.
Oh, it's that good old thing. That good old,
you know, like
religious shame. Good.
Also, there's this is also a cultural thing outside of the United States. In some cultures, it is not desirable to stand out
mm-hmm.
very far.
Interesting.
It's more desirable to be perceived as a team player. So there are many subtle ways that cultures do that, but also so there's, you know, public awareness. The other thing that's interesting there is that there are representatives of unions and employees that sit on the boards of those companies. Now that would never.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, it seems to me like such a logical thing. You know, the company is an organic whole. I mean, if everybody's not happy here, how are we going to produce the very best things? It's the same thing with just a couple or a family. I mean, it's all based on the same thing. It's communication, shared responsibility, and shared benefit.
Right.
It's just part of a healthy life.
Yes. So now I also want to make sure that at some point in this conversation, we go back to the practical aspects. You know, there's the geopolitical thing that is interesting to see mm-hmm. as motivators and drivers. On the other hand, the beauty of being in this place at this time is that it actually makes sense for capitalism to adopt this more open, transparent, inclusive, values-based style of management because it produced better results. We talked a little bit before about how it produces better financial results and investment mm-hmm. For those who are looking for long-term investments. In addition, in the marketplace, even before you count in the preference for green that may be emerging now, particularly service companies just perform better. Their customers are happier. They're more loyal. They will pay more for the service. They will become advocates when their interaction with the corporation is through an individual who cares.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And how does a corporation present individuals who care to their customers? It empowers them.
Well, I was going to say it has individuals that care.
It encourages it.
and creates
And
them.
It cares about them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a virtual circle, and we've done a number of fact-based analyses and studies, and we have zillions of cases of companies whose performance tracks better when they are deliberately managing against their values.
How do you deal with companies that are producing a product or a service that is actually deleterious to the environment or to the human society? Have you had to deal with industries that you're just like, oh my God, they're doing genetically modified food, it's destroying the diversity in the ecosystem? What do you do with those kinds of concerns?
Our feeling is that we are a very small company and we have limited resources and time.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're looking for is where can we have the greatest impact in raising hope and raising expectations of win-win solutions
mm-hmm.
and also giving companies the tools that they need, the processes and the management systems to put those in place. So that's been our focus. And in addition, you know, speaking and writing and all that.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to companies that we feel are behind the curve in terms of their motivation, what we have done is we've agreed to sit down in a half-day seminar and hold up a mirror and help them see what other stakeholders may see.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of the time, I would dare to say all the time, nobody thinks of themselves as bad, right? You may be managing a company, and you may have inherited a job or taken a job managing an extractive industry that has historically polluted vast amounts of resources and natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
But you go in there and you say, I'm going to do my best to mitigate this.
Mm-hmm.
We prefer not to work at this stage with companies who have such a steep learning curve or a steep turnaround curve.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that we don't need mining companies. We do. We need extractive.
Right.
Everything would grind to a halt. You and I couldn't sit here. We'd be sitting and we'd be freezing, you know, mm-hmm. in a 23-degree temperature outside. So I'm not saying, I'm not demeaning them, and I think that they're essential. And I hope that they will find the spark to, and our governments will find the spark to encourage them to invest in alternatives rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
However, we found that we can have greater value creating models that work.
With companies that are already moving in that direction to some degree.
Or whose hearts are committed to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And who need the tools.
I understand entirely, because I do energetic work, which is a side, but I can't work on people who haven't done a certain amount of work because it just is going to happen. They need to go through certain prerequisites or rudiments before they're ready for that. And I can see that makes complete sense to me.
Yeah.
But by creating these companies and helping them to define themselves, you're creating beacons for those companies that need to move in that direction.
Yeah, and we're creating best practices, mm-hmm. very practical tools, management tools. We come from a management consulting background. We know what it means when you when your competitor finds a tool that works, you want it too. The other thing that I'll say is that our clients tend to fall into two categories. They are either larger, well-established corporations who are committed to transformation, or smaller ones that are committed to transformation, or they are not-for-profits or social entrepreneur organizations who are looking for world-class business practices. Mm-hmm. So we find that we can inject, you know, help inject excellence in practices and effectiveness of organizations who are already committed to the greater good. Mm-hmm. Because, frankly, we believe in capitalism. Capitalism really works. I mean,
it's a free system, and actually it's very, from a spiritual base, it's actually the best system we have at this time because it's open to individual involvement, individual karma, individual gifts, deficits, whatever. It's all properly reflected by the magic hand of the marketplace.
It gets things done.
Yeah.
I mean, what we hope to do is raise its sights on what it's trying to get done.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had an interview with Ray Anderson, who's head of Interface, the largest carpet manufacturer in the world. He has been successful in reducing 60% of the greenhouse gas emissions footprint of this most toxic industry of carpet manufacturing. He did. His inspiration came from Paul Hawkins' book. And he just, and now he's a crusader around the world. He goes and he consults other CEOs, helps them, and he's an engineer. He's a left brain guy. Have you ever run into a situation when you're consulting a company where you've been in the midst of that transformation time and then all of a sudden of awakening, like, oh my gosh, look at the opportunity with this company.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And, it is just, it's like, it's explosive.
Mm-hmm.
But you also put your finger on something that, it really is the leader seeing that opportunity and having the heart to lead it. Heart, I mean courage.
Oh, it's a lot of work.
It's work, but it's also, also have to step back off that quarter-to-quarter earnings mm-hmm. treadmill for a little while.
Well, to hear this guy talk about a company that is so toxic, and it was so in the box. You know, carpet was a certain kind of material. And all of a sudden, it's like he had a bunch of hippies running around his company saying, hey, we can make carpet from, you know, thatch. And we can take the old carpet and cut it up and we can reintegrate it into this other product. It was like totally creative stuff, brilliant stuff, you know, to come up with all these recycling techniques. When you open up the human spirit in business, I think you see God. I think it's so exciting. I've been in company meetings where, you know, everybody's at a standstill. They're trying to figure out how to get through some kind of slowdown in sales or whatever. And then somebody cracks a joke, and everybody starts laughing, and the thing breaks open. And all of a sudden, the creative flow comes in. They go, well, this is something that's been here all along. Why don't we use so-and-so to do this particular project? And then you see the spark of engagement of the
yep.
people. They love their job. And to me, that's so important. It's like they really feel like they're part of the flow of life
mm-hmm.
and that their contribution is of great value. And that, to me, was when I've seen those moments, and I've seen it in all kinds of industries, banking, you know, manufacturing, whatever. It's when you have this engagement, this environment that is so desirable where everyone feels like, oh, they're part of this endeavor. It's like a team and we're going to do this and we're not going against the world. We're going for ourselves out into the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The interrupter,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, the wake up call, the interrupter, that's another role that that we play. And we play it also, you know, we've had the privilege of working with Grameen and other organizations whose founding was about using banking, for example, for the greater good. Grameen is another mm-hmm. example of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you get invited there for another reason. And the reason to get invited there is we think we've gone as far as we can with our heart and soul. And now we're wondering, how can we adapt the best practices in business without sullying our soul.
Mm.
And you have, I've experienced the same kind of exciting eureka from people who are sitting around a table saying, you know, we've been green forever and I don't want to play that commercial game.
Mm-hmm.
And when they see they can play it without trading off their value system, you have the same explosive excitement about what's possible for them. So it doesn't just go one way. We all have something to learn from each other. And it starts, I think, with an experience of trust and faith. And that really comes from the leadership
mm-hmm.
that says, it is safe to explore this. And I trust you and I trust me at what's in our hearts that we're going to do the right thing for our company as well as for our planet and our souls.
Do CEOs come to you through referrals, or do they find you on the internet, or how does that work?
Sometimes they find me in books, you know, mm-hmm. Patricia Aberdeen's Megatrends book, but it's mostly referrals.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes speaking engagements, but really it's mostly word of mouth. We keep a pretty low profile if they want us to. Usually we will not mention the name of our clients unless they're happy to have us do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're happy to make them heroes. You know, the world needs more heroes in this regard.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. How did you ever get into this? I mean, this is really, I know it sounds like a sidebar question, but it's really interesting for my audience to know how your life path got you into this amazing work. It's really quite fascinating. Was there a pivotal experience you had that said, you know, I'm going to go in this direction of consulting and working with companies?
You know, I've had, my life is a series of threshold pivotal experiences. It really is. I guess, you know, what first got me in this direction was my first husband, who said to me, you know, if you want to go to college, go right ahead. And so I did. And I discovered the glory that was 5th century Athens, studying at the City University. And it spoke to my heart, the honest search, you know, the seekers of truth, of the best, what does it mean to be the best human being that you can be?
Mm-hmm.
And they examined it in a logical, rational way. And then their poetry and art expressed it in an inspiring, scintillating way. So for me, that's a touchstone. And I went into journalism, business journalism after that, because I really wanted to see how things work. For me, the business world really determined how things worked.
Mm-hmm.
That was the power. That was the consolidated power, and I wanted to understand it. So I went into business journalism and did that for a little while with Institutional Investor magazine, and then discovered McKinsey & Company, which was, for me, this think tank of center of extraordinary excellence and human endeavor that was focused on helping companies to clarify the clearest path to success
mm-hmm.
with the best global practices. And then I was interested in learning more about what is the role of vision, of the leader's vision in determining that direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at McKinsey it was clear what the logical paths were and what the data suggested. But I wanted to get more closer to the heart that was directing the ship. And in those days, that was the 80s,
mm-hmm.
when essentially companies were run by a very small group of people. You know, it was the chairman and CEO, often the same person, and the president kind of implemented, and there was the board. So if you wanted to know where a company was going, you just tapped into the vision that was sitting in that room. And that's what I did in this world called corporate identity.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fascinating because you've talked about this, how thought creates reality.
Right.
And I was sitting there talking to people who were thinking where they wanted things to go, and my job was to figure out how, what would have to change in reality for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it was a very fascinating experience. And then it became clear to me in 1994 that there was this gap. And the gap was between the ability of the company, the machinery of the company, to keep chugging along separately from the heart and soul of the company.
Mm.
And I became increasingly uncomfortable with that. And in 1999, had a client, which was a mining company, that asked us to help them list on the New York Stock Exchange. We were positioning their corporate brand. And I said, okay, well, we're going to go and find out what it would take for the pension funds to buy it, the institutional investors to look upon you favorably. And I went and spoke with the lead institutional investor all-star analyst in this segment, and she said, well, they need to show leadership in three areas. One, in business management. I expected to hear that, Jeffrey.
Mm-hmm.
Two, they need to show leadership on environmental issues. This was 1999, and I couldn't believe what I heard. This
That's
is a hard-nosed
surprising.
Analyst. And third, they need to demonstrate leadership on social issues. And at that point, I said to her, now, wait a minute. Listen, I'm a business person. You don't have to talk that way to me.
This is a mining company.
Yeah, let's tell the truth. You're directing billions of dollars in pension fund assets here. And you're telling me, you're talking about this soft, airy-fairy leadership in environmental and social areas. And she said, no, there is a very practical application that they're not going to get that bridge interim financing, and the IMF is going to make it real hard for them. The World Bank is going to make it a disadvantage for them if there's even a whiff of environmental liability.
Interesting.
And third, in terms of social, they need to attract the top talent in a very specific small niche, and they're going to have to be better at providing what that talent needs, and as well as the image that that talent needs to feel proud of working there, not to mention the fact that the local governments in South America, where these mines are located, have reached their limit of tolerance. So the company that demonstrates leadership and consciousness in that system is going to be the preferred investment. So we went back to the chairman, to the big meeting, and I'm shaking in my boots. I've got to tell him this. He's going to think I'm airy-fairy here, right? So we did tell him, here's your opportunity. He banged his hand on the desk and he said, well, that's what I want, the triple bottom line. And Jeffrey, it was at that point that I disbanded my company and said, we are going to reinvent our services to help companies with the economic argument for this transformation.
It's wonderful to hear that.
Well, this is the great pitfall, I think, for all of us. Don't underestimate the human spirit that's running those companies, that perhaps needs to keep a low profile, that is waiting for the opportunity to see enough peer models that say, okay, it's okay, I'm going to be who I really am.
Yeah. Well, and it kind of mirrors what's going on in so many other areas. The art world is moving into a different dimensional awareness, not just postmodernism. You know, everything is kind of like at this pivotal turning point, and things are kind of turning over, and there are step-out leaders. There are out-front people doing things, and they are inspiring other people. Ray Anderson's inspiring a lot of people around the globe. He taught this one company in London how to channel all the methane gas off the landfill to power all the needs in the company down the way. It's really very innovative and very clever and also quite useful and help their bottom line. And isn't that basically what it comes down to? It's gonna affect their profitability and their success as a business to do the right thing.
Yes, and that's the excuse they need. But the real reason to do it is the glory that it brings to the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And there is case after case of this where market success and employee satisfaction start to skyrocket together. That's the future model.
That's great. Elsie, what brings you the most joy in your life?
Ah! Well, you know, the first thing that popped into my head when you said that was spending time with my nieces and nephews and my godchildren, who are all on the East Coast, who range in age from 8 to 22, and who I had the opportunity to see most of them this past couple of weeks. They know the answers.
And they're the next. They're the next generation. They're going to be bringing in the next herald of communication of how human beings behave with each other.
And they trust themselves. Mm-hmm. Do you know, they don't have the baggage we have of having been in systems that this is the way it's worked. So I guess this is the way it's got to work.
Mm-hmm.
They're fresh. They're enthusiastic, and that's the other group not to underestimate. So, I guess that's an answer to your question.
I think this sounds like a really nice horizon coming up.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful sunrise. I mean, from hearing you speak today, it's most wonderful. And I applaud you, and they can find information on your company. I'll have it on the show notes, on the podcast notes, on the website, omniartsalon.com. And good luck to the presentation. What's the name of your presentation at the conference? Do you remember?
I think it's called Soul Branding, How Authentic Is Your Marketing Really?
Oh, that's a good one. Well, Elsie, I have one question I ask everyone who's on the show. It goes like this. If there are one thing you could tell the whole world that they need to know, but they really aren't getting, what would that one thing be?
It's that we all want the same thing, and that it's in our power to give it to ourselves and each other.
That's brilliantly said. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank
you, Jeffrey.
And
we're going to have you back. This has been great fun.
This was fun for me, too. Thank you so much.
Delightful.